Our next case is number 21-1989, Mitek Systems, Inc. v. United Services Automobile Association. Okay, Mr. Mack.
Good morning, Your Honors. Brian Mack of Quinn Emanuel on behalf of Declaratory Judgment Plaintiff and Appellant Mitek Systems, Inc. This is a classic patent infringement scenario where the patentee strategically decides to sue the deep pockets, in this case, the end customer banks, instead of suing the supplier of the technology, Mitek. Now, there's nothing inherently wrong or improper with strategically deciding to sue the end users for patent infringement.
What are you suggesting by the use of the term strategically that isn't, there's some nefarious or something implication. What's the suggestion?
Well, there's a pattern of behavior here where they're going after
two lawsuits.
There's the Wells Fargo lawsuit against Wells Fargo where they received $300 million in jury damages, and that case was settled. Then they went after PNC Bank, and then they filed a third lawsuit against BBVA Bank as well.
Right,
so it's a serial litigation strategy.
Right, and the strategy which you want to cast a negative light on, would the negative... The appropriateness of casting the negative light be affected by whether there's a serious case for contributory or induced infringement? Because if there isn't, then why would you be disparaging the strategy?
I'm not disparaging the strategy. I mean, my next point was going to be that there is nothing improper with that strategy. But if you do strategically decide to sue the end users, you open yourself up for a declaratory judgment suit from the supplier of that technology. And that's exactly what happened here.
On the case or controversy side of this, am I right in thinking that there are two potential interests here that are affected? One is the potential for Mitek's liability as a, conceivably direct infringer, but I think maybe more likely as a possible indirect infringer. And then the other is costs you might incur by virtue of indemnity agreements, whether it's actual indemnity liability or obligation to defend or something.
Correct, Your Honor. And we actually, the allegations in our original complaint said that we have an apprehension of both direct infringement and indirect inducement and contributory infringement, depending on the claims.
I don't see that your allegations of the original complaint said some of the things that you say it said in your brief. Your brief is not entirely accurate in characterizing the complaint. And I read the complaint, and there is a mention of indemnity, but I don't see that it clearly says that the indemnity obligation arises from direct customer infringement that leads to the indemnity obligation. At the time that you drafted this original complaint, it focused on the Wells Fargo situation, which is now over with.
Right.
Wells Fargo is settled, and there's no potential for Wells Fargo liability. So we have to look to the other parts of the complaint that don't relate to Wells Fargo, and it's a bit thin, it seems to me.
Well, I can explain briefly the history. So Mitek and its general counsel, and I was actually at the trial as well, at the Wells Fargo trial, the apprehension of direct and indirect infringement claims did not arise until we saw the jury presentation of USAA's infringement expert, Professor Conti. And we cited, it's in our opening brief at pages 8 and 9, we cited the appendix record, the entire slides that Dr. Conti used as demonstratives in front of the jury. That's at appendix 658 to 766. There's 15 slides just for claim one of the 571 patent that cite Mitek source code, Mitek documentation that is given to customers, and Mitek witnesses that Dr. Conti and the USA versus Wells Fargo trial used to show infringement. So the general counsel of Mitek...
There may have been, in the context of the Wells Fargo litigation, a case of controversy between Mitek and the patentee, but the Wells Fargo litigation is over with, so I have to look to the complaint to find out what the allegations are with respect to other customers. And what I suggested a moment ago is that it strikes me that they're a bit thin because they do talk about indemnification, but they don't suggest that there is going to be direct infringement liability for the customers as a result of the use of the MyTech software. It just doesn't dot the I's and cross the T's the way it needed to. I mean, show me where in the complaint it says the customers are going to be held liable for direct infringement for using our software, and this leads to an indemnification obligation.
At Appendix 31, we state that MyTech has various contractual relationships with its customers, including OEM agreements related to MySnap and MyTech's mobile deposit product offering. These agreements include indemnification provisions relating to actual or alleged patent infringement by MyTech's technology. In response to USAA's massive enforcement and letter writing campaign, MyTech has received demands for indemnification.
Okay, but that says we're getting indemnification demands. It doesn't say the customers are subject to infringement liability for using our software.
We then go in each, there's a patent-specific section for each patent. If you go to paragraph 30 of the complaint at Appendix 36, we walk through Claim 1 in the 779 patent, and we point out that Wells Fargo relies on MyTech source code, MyTech documentation, and MyTech testimony to show infringement of this claim at the Wells Fargo trial.
That's Wells Fargo. Where does it say that about other people?
There's no reason to believe the infringement allegations here are central to MyTech's product offer.
Where does the complaint say that the other customers are in the same position as Wells Fargo?
Well, the problem there is that there's a lack of transparency because we're not signed on to the protective order in any of these cases. So we're not privy to the expert reports. We're not privy to even the infringement contentions. What we have and what we know is that we sat through the Wells Fargo lawsuit. We saw how central MySnap was to the infringement allegations in that lawsuit. Immediately after the Wells Fargo lawsuit, you have USAA's CEO.
Counsel, on page 36, lines 23 through 26, you make a statement about MyTech and all of its MySnap customers are presently faced with a substantial risk of litigation. What's the underlying support for that statement that you're making there?
So after the Wells Fargo lawsuit, there was a public notice by USAA that put the entire industry on notice. And they said, if you're using the same technology as Wells Fargo, MySnap, which is technology that's provided by my client, MyTech, then they should be on notice that they also may face these infringement allegations.
That's true. I thought the way I read that press release, there were statements by the author or some journalist that might be the case. You attribute that statement to the patentee, but I don't.
There were some direct quotations from MyTech employees.
Show me where does it attribute that statement to USAA?
And Your Honor, the reasonable apprehension of Sue.
No. Where does it say? Where you attribute in your briefs that statement to USAA? I don't see that supported by the record.
I believe it was an interview of USAA's employees, and it was an American banker. You're right, it is an American, it was a journalist from American Banker. It's a really widely read periodical in this industry. And it did quote USAA's employees, putting them on notice that they are going to be subject to suits as well.
Show me where USAA said that, or its employees said that.
Let me see the public warning to the industry. It's at Appendix 768. And that's the article I believe that Your Honor is referring to. That's the American Banker article at Appendix 768. There are quotations in that article from USAA's employees inviting them to take licensing opportunities with USAA. I mean, it's clear from the pattern of behavior. There's also a history of litigation between these companies. So, I mean, the substantial controversy.
But just where does this say, put statements like that in the mouth of USAA? I mean, there's a statement on 770, but that's a journalist's assessment.
There's also quotations from USAA's employees.
Well, there are, yes, but not to that effect.
Your Honor, it's not just this one statement. It's the under the Microsoft case, there just needs to be a reasonable probability that claims would be filed to have standing. And here we've We have the Wells Fargo lawsuit. We have all of the demonstratives used by their infringement expert. We have in the record over 15 slides at Wells Fargo that cited MyTech source code and documentation to show infringement. We also have all the indemnification demands coming in during this widely publicized lawsuit. MyTech received dozens of requests for indemnification. While it's true that MyTech hasn't voluntarily assumed liability, that's not the standard. I don't think there's a requirement that you have to, that a small software company has to assume this huge liability from a bank in order to have standing. What we find is that we're being subpoenaed in every single one of these lawsuits for source code, for technical documentation, and for witness testimony. We've been subpoenaed in the Wells Fargo.
You attached one letter, right? Was it one letter in particular, but there are thousands of letters? Is that right?
The letter writing campaign was sent to over 1,000 banks, and we attached one representative letter. That's correct. So, and that was USAA's letter writing campaign that was focused out of the Bay Area from the law firm that they selected to use, yes.
And so the letter that you attached, though, didn't focus on one of the patents in suit, right? In terms of the claim chart, it was for a patent that wasn't one of the ones in suit?
That's correct, Your Honor. That letter did attach a claim chart, and it also had a patent list that included the patents in suit in list form, and then it had a claim chart that detailed the infringement allegations with respect to a patent that's not in suit.
Now, the list included 3 out of 4 of the patents in suit, right? Not all 4.
Right. So there's 2 different patent families, and I think at the time that letter was sent, one of the patents hadn't issued yet, but it included at least 1 patent in each of the 2 families, and there's continuation patents. So it either directly or indirectly included all of the patents.
Is there anything in the record about the other letters? Did they have anything that, in terms of the claim charts, were they on any of the patents in suit?
I do not believe so.
Can I ask you my understanding is that in the Fifth Circuit, I think probably more widely, but in particular in the Fifth Circuit, a 12B1 motion can be treated and needs to be treated differently according to how the opponent of the motion responds. If the opponent of the motion responds with at least certain kinds of facts, affidavits, or maybe other kind of evidence, that turns the 12B1 motion into an opportunity for factual resolution. If not, then the 12B1 motion is resolved the way you would resolve a 12B6 motion, on the basis of complaint and things that can be taken judicial notice of and things like that. Didn't the district court here effectively adopt the first path when USAA responded, said, look at the Wells Fargo litigation. There's no serious risk of any kind of infringement liability, and we also dispute with at least some citations to evidence that you really do have a indemnification risk that is traceable to this.
So,
and that would then change our standard of review, right?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. In the Fifth Circuit, it's clear that the Judge Gilstrap cited the Choice Incorporated of Texas case in assessing jurisdiction. The district court is to accept as true the allegations and facts set forth in the complaint. There's a notion in the Fifth Circuit for jurisdictional questions for verifiable facts, and these are usually historical facts. If you look at all the case law that was cited, it was whether a ship qualified as a vessel. It was an admiralty law, the N. Ray S. Recycling case, or whether a Navy sailor was acting within the scope of his naval employment at the time of a car accident. There was a negligence case about a sailor and whether he was acting within the scope of his employment. Again, that's the Montez case. That's an admiralty law case. So if there is a predicate fact that concerns some historical or verifiable fact, there is some case law in the Fifth Circuit that says they can pierce the allegations in the complaint just with respect to those historical or verifiable facts. None of the facts here are disputed. I mean, USAA sent thousands of letters to banks asking it to take license.
The facts are disputed. I mean, they're saying it's not, your software is not as central to the infringement as you claim that it is. I mean, if there were here a hearing, instead of judging this on the face of the complaint, or there were an amendment under Rule 15 to make the complaint more detailed, is there more that could be presented here?
What we could present, what we're privy to, is what we saw at the Wells Fargo case. We have the infringement allegations, the entire presentation from Professor Conti, and we know how central MySnap was to those allegations. All of the main limitations of the claim, there's only three steps to these claims. If you look at these claims, they're incredibly broad. There's three steps to the claims. There's a monitoring step, there's a capturing step, and then there's a transmission step. Some of the claims don't even have the last step. It's only a few of the patents
that
have
that. But it seems to me the problem is that there seems to be some variability among customers as to how they use the software, how they customize it. I don't know whether that means that they turn on and off various features of your software or exactly what that means. But apparently there is some variability in what the customers do. So how do we know that what you keep referring to in the Wells Fargo litigation is typical of what the situation is with respect to other customers?
Well, Judge Dyke, MyTech is a software company. They provide the software. It operates in several different ways, but they have to support all of the different options. So there is an automatic capture mode. There's a manual capture mode. MyTech supports both. The software supports both. They have to test both. So you don't even have to look at the customer. There's directly infringing, an allegation of direct infringement by MyTech when it tests the products, it tests the software. They have to test all the bells and whistles. They have to load the software onto a mobile phone. The mobile phone has a communication pathway back to the server. All the elements are there. There's nothing else needed to show infringement. There's really allegations of direct infringement and testing by MyTech.
Well, you haven't said in the complaint that there's an allegation of direct infringement, have you?
We do in the complaint have indirect and direct infringement, Your Honor. So paragraph 11 and 12 of the complaint, the final sentence, MyTech therefore has...
What page are we on?
Appendix 31, paragraph 12 of the complaint. Paragraphs 11 and 12 kind of summarize the allegations with the final sentence. MyTech therefore has a real and substantial apprehension of imminent litigation between MyTech and USAA for direct infringement, inducement, and contributory infringement. And the paragraphs before that explain why.
And the direct infringement is a realistic possibility, notwithstanding what you tout as USAA's strategy not to sue you, but to sue your customers.
I mean, we don't have a covenant not to sue. They could provide MyTech a covenant not to sue, and we wouldn't be here today, but they haven't done that. So there's nothing preventing USAA from turning around tomorrow and filing a lawsuit against MyTech for direct infringement, from testing the products, from building the products in their test labs on real phones. They put it on real Android devices, real Apple devices.
Okay, but it doesn't say that. I mean, it doesn't talk about testing as being direct infringement, does it?
I don't believe it gives the example of testing, but it does say direct and indirect infringement. And I think under the ARIS...
It's somewhat ambiguous as to whether it's referring to direct infringement by MyTech or by the customers and induced and contributory infringement by MyTech. But
Well, under this court's precedence of ARIS and Microsoft v. DataTurn, there's an implied assumption of indirect infringement when there's an allegation of direct infringement by the customer. So that's implicit, that's implied. But we, more than in being implied, we sat through the Wells Fargo trial and we actually saw what the allegations were by their infringement expert. He stepped through all the limitations. 15 different slides of source code of MyTech put up in front of the jury. MyTech documentation that's provided to customers. That's all you really need to show inducement. You need to show that there's a method claim and that MyTech is aware of the patent, which they obviously are now that there's a lawsuit. MyTech provides customer-facing documentation to its customers, like all software companies do, to configure the products, to use the products. All the elements of inducement are there at a minimum. And even if, in addition to...
You think that there is in this documentation the kind of, I guess, what in the pharmaceutical inducement cases we call instructions to use?
So if you, yes, Your Honor, if you look in the appendix at the slide that Dr. Conti, Professor Conti, excuse me, cited, there's MyTech source code cited.
Can I look at something?
Sure. It's appendix 711 through 719. This is for the capture limitation where MyTech source code is being cited. And then if you want to see a MyTech documentation, it's Appendix 720 and 721 and 722. There's a MyTech SDK Programmer's Guide, and there's a MyTech Developer's Guide. These were all used by Professor Conte to show infringement at the Wells Fargo case. They were
right. Working. So let me just to make sure that I'm communicating what I'm focused on. So the piece of inducement, put aside contributory infringement, just on the theory that by turning off the automatic feature, your product has material uses that are non-infringing. Put aside the possibility of testing, just focusing on inducement. There's not only the knowledge of the patent, there's this element of encouragement, intentional encouragement, for which we have a tolerably high standard that requires something like instructions. Now, that wouldn't have been a material thing to prove in the Wells Fargo case because there wasn't an inducement case. So I guess I'm very focused on the question, is there actually a real possibility of your being sued for inducement based on whatever you communicate in, software guides or something?
Yes, Your Honor. All software companies provide guides on how to configure and use the software. These examples on Appendix 720, the MyTech SDK Programmer's Guide, that's the Software Development Kit Programmer's Guide, that's a document intended to be given to the end users, the customers, the banks, the financial services companies that are integrating the software into the bank software. So Appendix 720 is the Programmer's Guide, and Appendix 721 is the Developer's Guide. That's another example of a document. The Developer's Guide shows how to configure all the features. That's all that's really needed. It shows you how to turn it on. It shows you how to turn off each feature. And what you mentioned about the automatically capturing, there's only two of the patents used the phrase automatically capturing. The other two patents just say capture without the word automatically. So Judge Gilstrap actually construed that very broadly, so it may actually include other things than automatically capturing. So if you look at the claims of the 571 and the 090 patent, those don't even say automatically capturing. They say capture. So those could arguably be infringed by both modes, the manual mode and the automatic mode. But regardless, we're a software company. We support both modes. We support both modes to our customers. We explain to them how to use both modes. We provide documentation. Some of the documentation was shown to the jury in the Wells Fargo case. There's really nothing preventing USAA from suing MyTech other than the fact that we don't have as deep pockets as the banks. And it would change the entire Georgia-Pacific analysis, the damages analysis. This is what the Declaratory Judgment Act is designed to do. It's like to avoid unreasonable licensing demands. The strategy of suing these large banks, extracting exorbitant licensing fees, and then suing another bank, extracting exorbitant licensing fees, this could go on until the patents expire, 6 years after the patents expire. MyTech's going to get dragged into each case, subpoenaed for its source code, for its technical documentation, and the subpoenas are in the record, Your Honor. The subpoenas are at Appendix 633 in the Wells Fargo case and Appendix 1021 for the PNC case. You can look at how broad those subpoenas are. MyTech has a reasonable apprehension of being sued just by virtue of being subpoenaed for its technical documentation for USAA to show infringement.
Well, that seems to ask us to assume that the Wells Fargo situation is representative of the situation with respect to other clients, right?
I mean, Your Honors probably know as well as I do, these are kind of copycat cases. They're being filed at one bank after another to extract licensing.
Okay, but
I mean, this,
the problem is you didn't say that. Their complaint doesn't say that the Wells Fargo situation is typical of what
we're not privy to any confidential information in the PNC case. We haven't signed on to the protective order. We don't know exactly what their allegations are against PNC until the PNC trial is scheduled, I think, in 3 weeks to go forward. We're going to be sitting at that trial again. We're going to watch another one of our customers pay exorbitant licensing fees for these patents.
But Judge Cunningham asked you about these other letters. You must have the other letters, right?
There are hundreds of letters. We attached one, and then we alleged that there were others.
You have the other letters, right?
I believe so. I don't know if we have the one specifically for PNC.
Okay, but do the other letters tie the infringement allegation to your software?
The letters, from what I understand, were copy and paste letters. They were exactly the same, and some of them attached infringement charts, some of them did not attach infringement charts, but they were boilerplate copy and paste.
I mean, you know what your customers' products look like, right?
And that's why I think MyTech is in the best position.
And they're using your software?
Yes. Well, they are using it. We know to a degree. We help them.
Are there other suppliers of similar software in the market generally?
The issue here is that there's third-party integrators. So there's companies like Fiserv and NCR and Senta, which is a Jack Henry Corporation now. They help the end-user banks. They take our software and they help the end-user banks like Wells Fargo develop their product. Or the end-user banks develop the product on their own with some assistance from MyTech. If they need support or there's a bug that needs fixing, they may contact MyTech directly and ask them, put in a support ticket with MyTech. But this is very confidential. I mean, each bank's implementation, while it is specific to that bank, the core functionality, the core technology that performs the bulk of the claim limitations is performed by my client's software. That's the MySnap software. The monitoring and the capture limitations, if you look at the infringement allegations, relying on the source code and the technical documents from MyTech, as well as potentially some source code and technical documents from the banks as well. But we feel that we're in the best situation to defend our product from these allegations of infringement. We want to assist our end users and customers. We feel like they shouldn't be dragged through all this litigation. We're in the best position to handle the discovery, to handle the invalidity of the patents, to handle the non-infringement of the patents. And that's why we're here asking for jurisdiction.
Your DJ action requested a declaratory judgment of non-infringement, not of invalidity. Am I remembering that right?
That's correct. If it requested invalidity, then we wouldn't have been able to file the patent office proceedings, which we filed. So that was another point in the brief. Our DJ action is only for non-infringement. And then what typically happens is there'll be a compulsory counterclaim of infringement, and then we'll file affirmative defenses of invalidity. So it'll all get rolled up into the case eventually.
Are there patent office proceedings ongoing now?
That was another point made in the brief. Most of the petitions were discretionarily denied because USAA argued that we have too close of a relationship with our banks.
Yeah, but are there any pending?
Not anymore. That's another, we have no avenue to defend ourselves. The patent office discretionarily denied the petitions because USAA argued that we were too closely tied to our end users. Now they're arguing that we don't have any substantial controversy, so we can't even file a declaratory judgment action. So it really leaves us with no avenue to defend ourselves.
Is intervention still available in other suits? You just said there's no avenue.
It could be, but in order to intervene, there's a lot, the briefing makes a lot about intervening in the Wells Fargo case and why we didn't intervene in the Wells Fargo case. Wells Fargo was one of the only banks that actually didn't ask for indemnification. We couldn't have intervened. I don't think you have a legal right to intervene if you're not, we didn't stand in their shoes by virtue of any indemnification in the Wells Fargo case. PNC did request indemnity. NCR, the third-party integrator that works with PNC, also sent us a separate letter for indemnification, and that's in the record. BBVA, the third target, they also requested indemnification. So we could intervene theoretically in those cases. But again, I mean, it's their strategic decision to sue the banks. So instead of intervening, we decided to file a declaratory judgment action on behalf of all the customers yet to be sued. We filed immediately during the jury trial, the Wells Fargo case, and we filed before the PNC case was filed. We filed our declaratory judgment action. And if you look at this case, the precedent of this court, that's the exact purpose of the Declaratory Judgment Act.
Can I just ask you, I'm sorry, just one more question. So putting aside the question of case or controversy, Judge Gilstrap, at the end of his opinion, said, declaratory judgment remedy under 22.1 is discretionary and in a very abbreviated way, but thinking about what that abbreviation was an abbreviation of, I guess I perhaps would attribute him to be saying that that he just thinks that intervention in the next suit in which you actually do have some indemnity risk is a more efficient way of you vindicating your rights. And why is that not a sufficient basis for his ruling?
Well, Your Honor, it's very clear under this court's Micron case and the electronics for imaging case that the quote is, dismissal is rarely proper when the objectives of the Declaratory Judgment Act are served. And here we filed our Declaratory Judgment Act during the first jury trial before we knew all our other customers were going to be sued in a serial fashion to kind of preempt all future actions. And that you won't find a fact pattern. The cases that they cite for discretionary denial.
Why would it not be sufficient? Let's assume Judge Gilstrap had said, never mind Wells Fargo, although I actually now know a lot about the matter. But if you're truly worried, MITAC, about other customers being sued, the next one that happens, intervene there. That's a preferable way for you to vindicate your rights than a declaratory judgment action, in part because the software may be changed, in part because the instructions or other communications that might constitute encouragement for inducement might be case specific, and that's just a better way to proceed, and I don't really see, it's a better way to proceed.
A couple observations there. A declaratory judgment act, we can have one action to kind of vindicate our software that's used by all the banks in one action rather than indemnifying and intervening in all the serial cases. Also, it's a different posture.
Unless your communications with your various customers varies from customer to customer, changing the inducement analysis. Or is your DJ action going to be about all of your 1,000 customers and all of your communications with them to establish that you've never done anything called encouragement?
That's true, but the documentation that's given to the end customers is identical. It's these programmers' guides that we looked at earlier or the SDK guides. So there are commonalities across all the cases. I think a DJ action is the most efficient way to resolve these issues. But the larger picture here, MITAC is a small software company based in San Diego, a few hundred employees. To require MITAC to assume this massive liability of banks, $300 million, I'm not sure what MITAC's revenue is each year, but I don't think it's $300 million. To have MITAC assume liability of a bank in order to intervene into each one of these cases, I just don't know if that's something that should be encouraged by this court as a matter of policy.
Why do they have to assume liability to intervene?
Well, I believe we would have to accept the indemnification request, and the indemnification language, there's standard indemnification language in all of our OEM agreements that says that
we can't intervene because of the possibility of indemnification obligations.
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I would assume that we would have to agree to accept indemnity to intervene, to have an interest sufficient enough to intervene. I don't know if there's cases on that, but that would be my assumption.
You mentioned the indemnification language, and can you describe more of that or point me to a page where I could see it that you were getting to describe that?
The indemnification language is actually, it wasn't made part of the public record because it's confidential. It's in the OEM agreements with each specific, it's either directly in an agreement with the end user bank, BBVA, there's a direct relationship between MITAC and BBVA, so there is a direct indemnification language between those two parties. The other indemnification language is between MITAC and those third-party integrators like NCR, Fiserv, FIS. There's several companies that help the banks integrate the software. So you would have to look to the language of those. But it's very specific. It's fact-specific, obviously. The language is different in each of the agreements. There hasn't been any judicial determination that MITAC has any indemnity obligations. What we allege is that they're facially colorable requests for indemnification, which should be sufficient under this court's precedence and the Aris and Microsoft v. DataTurn case. For a substantial controversy to exist here.
Okay, well, we're way over time.
Sorry, so, thank you.
It's our question, it's not yours. We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Glasser.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'd like to start just by briefly making two corrections to the record regarding statements that were made by the appellant The first relates to Appendix 769, which is what was described by appellants as a threat made by USAA regarding these patents in suit. Now, if we look at Appendix 769, what we see is not only, as your honors pointed out, that this is something that was actually written by a third party and not by USAA, but I think actually even more importantly, this was about a completely different set of patents. This article here has to do with the second lawsuit between USAA and Wells Fargo, which related not to any of the four patents in suit here, but to two completely different patents. The second correction to the record is that appellant had suggested that the reason the 090 patent is not included in its example letter was it had issued later. That is also not correct. As we can see from the face of the 090 patent issued in November 2017, the letter is dated from late January 2018. So I wanted to just make those points clear.
I thought all four patents were mentioned in the letter, but the claim chart related to a different patent. Am I wrong about that?
So three of the patents were mentioned in a list of patents that was at the end that was described as, quote, a list of USAA's issued patents. One of them, though, the 090, was not even included in that generalized list.
Okay.
And then Your Honor is correct that the one that was charted was not one of these four. And just to be completely explicit about the relationship, it's not that it was a family member or somehow indicative of the other four. The 227 patent that was charted is actually a patent from a completely different patent family. We can see that on the face of the four patents that are in the record. It is not part of the file history for any of those patents. It's not part of the continuation chain. It's just a completely different patent, different invention, different priority date. And so
the 090, though, is related to one of the patents in that list, correct? Like one of them's a parent?
That is correct. The 090 is related to the 571 patent, yes. And so what's interesting about the letter, and appellant's counsel acknowledged that all of the letters were, at least based on my text apprehension, copy-paste, I think he said, and that the one that was submitted to the district court was, in appellant's words, representative. And so what we see from the record is that the only letter that has ever been forwarded to my tech, this representative letter, none of these letters even chart any of the four patents in this case.
What about in the Wells Fargo litigation? Were all four patents involved in the Wells Fargo litigation?
The first Wells Fargo litigation, again, not the one that's referenced in the article that counsel was discussing, but the first Wells Fargo litigation initially asserted all four of those patents. And by the time it got to trial, it had been narrowed down. The 571 patent was asserted and went to verdict, as was that 090 patent.
Okay, so in the Wells Fargo litigation, your client accused Wells Fargo of infringing by using the MyTech software, right?
I don't agree with that, Your Honor. I think Wells Fargo and MyTech and USAA were all very, very clear during that trial that while the MyTech software was a component that Wells Fargo had purchased either directly or indirectly and had customized, that there were numerous aspects, including aspects required to satisfy the claim elements, that either had nothing to do with MyTech at all or were highly customized by Wells Fargo. I can provide a few record examples of that. I think there's at least...
Well, I mean, the patents require more than photographing, but for the purpose, in terms of the photographing of the check, which I guess is the inventive, claimed inventive aspect of these patents, for the photographing of the check, is done using the MyTech software, right?
So the inventive aspect of the invention went well beyond just the photographing, but the photographing itself was actually performed by a combination of, I may be missing one, but at least three different things. The photographing was by the customized MyTech software, independent Wells Fargo code, and then also actually there was a piece of it by the an example of an Apple phone, the Apple code actually is involved in that as well. And so there's at least three different things going on just for that one element in particular. And in general, for the patents themselves, there was...
Put it this way, that the proof of the use of the MyTech software by Wells Fargo was an indispensable element of the proof of direct infringement.
So I don't think you would have had to reference the MyTech software in particular, but MyTech was the vendor that Wells Fargo had chosen.
I'm sorry, what's your answer to my question?
It wouldn't have had to be MITEC necessarily.
I don't care whether it has to be MITEC, but the allegation was that the MITEC software here was an indispensable ingredient of the proof of direct infringement.
In the sense that Wells Fargo had chosen to use MITEC and use that as the basis to customize, and that ultimately satisfied one of the claim elements. That is correct, Your Honor. But Wells Fargo didn't need the MITEC software in particular to accomplish this. And then there
So what? I understand what that has to do with anything.
I just wanted to be clear, Your Honor.
It was accused based on the use of the MITEC software.
Well, that aspect I definitely don't agree with. And there were certain other elements of the claims that are just totally unrelated to the Microsoft software, for example. I don't know if I'm engaging with your question properly. I want to just make sure and be very explicit about which pieces of it related to the MITEC and which parts did not. So there's
Which pieces did not? Put aside the mobile device.
Yes, for the mobile device, of course, Your Honor. Probably the clearest example, because the record was very explicit that it was done entirely by Wells Fargo, is the, get the exact quote of the language so that we can hear, the transmission via communication pathway element. So when we look at appendix...
Sending the photograph to the bank.
That's correct. Yeah, that one had nothing to do with the MITEC.
But in terms of taking the actual photograph, that's the MITEC software, right?
That's a combination of the MITEC software, the Wells Fargo configuration, and then that was the piece actually.
So
that
the Wells Fargo configuration, in other words, the choice they made within the MITEC software to activate a particular feature.
It goes beyond that. There is configuration files that are adopted by Wells Fargo, and it's not just whether to do it automatically or manually. That's one piece that was discussed in the briefing. But the other piece of it that is much more highly customized is the monitoring criterion. So monitoring criterion are an element of all these claims as well. And those ones are an instance where I think that the testimony from the expert was they have full control here.
Could explain what monitoring criteria are, please?
Well, I want to be careful of that. That's a claim element. To give some examples, though, I think of what was actually at issue here. There were things like how much the software is focused on lightness or brightness in the background would be one example. I don't recall actually off the top of my head if Wells Fargo
did this, but
corners.
Here, I guess, is something that I, when reading the brief and in this discussion too, I'm every time I hear the word customize, I ask myself, well, if they're choosing red or blue, red or blue have nothing to do with the claim element, they can have lots of customization, and I don't think that would matter in the slightest. So the only kind of custom, and I didn't see in your brief, you're narrowing the evidence about customization to choices about fulfilling or not fulfilling a claim element, except choosing options already provided within the MITEC software, which then takes you to this sort of scenario of options provided with either sufficient or insufficient instructions. But I didn't understand all this customization language ever to have been narrowed to choices between satisfying a claim element and not satisfying a claim element.
Let me see if I can engage with that directly. So the MITEC software, as I understand it, provides ways that different options that somebody could select. And then Wells Fargo has its own configuration files, is my understanding. So Wells Fargo could choose to either override what is already in the system. They could choose to adopt some but not all. They could choose to use some but adjust them so that they're less exact, right? So you could choose to have it trigger not necessarily on a particular threshold but on something that is, you know, X percentage off of the threshold, et cetera. And so the monitoring criterion is something that I think every bank is going to be doing differently. And in fact, a bank could decide to completely override it entirely if they chose to do that. They certainly don't need to be doing that.
And those choices would or would not change whether the resulting software met some claim element.
Those could easily change whether it satisfied the element, because each of these patents includes an element that either expressly requires the monitoring criterion or is talking about a specific type of monitoring criterion, such as an alignment guide.
But that sounds as though the customer could render the process non-infringing by customizing it so that it's not infringing. if they use the MyTech software, isn't there an allegation that that causes an infringement?
So the MyTech software standing alone isn't going to be performing all the elements of the claim.
I understand the mobile phone, the transmission, but in terms of the photographic aspect of it.
So yeah, the customer could implement that piece in a way that satisfies those claim elements, or they could choose to implement in a way where it does not satisfy those claim elements. That's absolutely true.
Okay, so didn't MyTech suggest to the customers, wasn't there evidence in the Wells Fargo case that suggested to the customers that they do the photographing in a way that would satisfy the claim limitations?
That was not part of the trial one way or the other. I mean, as was discussed earlier, the intent of MyTech was not at issue. The only reason that
But in terms of the apparently was some evidence of the instructions they gave to the customers. My question is, doesn't that evidence tend to show that they instructed their customers to use it in a way that would meet the claim limitations concerning photographing?
I have to say that was just not at all part of the trial or the record. The way that this came up, Your Honor, at the trial was that MyTech chose to appear as a witness to try to explain that part of the capture limitation wasn't met. In particular, they were directed at a sub-piece of it, which was the timing. They wanted to show, this is another one of those customization things, right? They wanted to show that the timing of the capture was occurring at a different time than USAA was saying it was occurring. And the reason that those manuals came into the record was purely because as to that sort of sub-piece of a sub-part of an element, the manuals contradicted what the MyTech witness had said. And so other than that, there was no inquiry into the manuals or what sort of instructions were given. It was just to show there was statements in their own manuals that were the opposite of what they were telling the jury.
Okay, but the two of you seem to have different views of the record and the facts. Perhaps the right thing to do here would be to send this case back to Judge Gelstrap with an instruction to have a jurisdictional hearing to determine whether, in fact, there are allegations here that would satisfy induced infringement standards sufficient to support declaratory judgment instead of trying to do this based on the vague allegations that are before us now and the argument of counsel.
So I think that actually would make a lot of sense if we had a concrete customer and the parties were fighting about what is going on with this particular customer, because the district court obviously would need to satisfy himself of whether or not there's a live controversy and an indemnity obligation with respect to that customer. So fortunately, I think for all of us to simplify what's a fairly complicated set of facts a little bit, Wells Fargo is definitely over. The Wells Fargo piece of it is not in play.
Does it matter that when the complaint was filed, which is usually the time that jurisdiction has to be decided, Wells Fargo was not over?
I think at that time, it did appear that MyTech was actually seeking to collaterally attack that judgment. And so the Wells Fargo case did actually appear to be part of the complaint. MyTech since then has taken that off the table. MyTech actually stated in its first briefing to the California District Court that Wells Fargo case is over. And I'll get the exact quote because I think it does take that what would otherwise be a complicated issue off the table. MyTech said, quote, "The Wells Fargo trial is over, and this lawsuit involves an entirely different accused product." And so
you said that in what?
In the briefing to the California District Court, which is at Appendix 485. MyTech's counsel said that at Appendix 485. I think that statement alone, it simplifies the issues quite a bit, and it also goes to this issue we've been talking about, which is, are we talking about a situation where we're really just talking about MyTech? Are we talking about a situation where we need to look at who is the actual infringer and what is it that they're doing? I think the record is clear on its own, but it's quite helpful to have that statement by MyTech as well, which tells us the same thing.
A question arose in the briefing and also earlier in this argument about exactly what MyTech would have to establish in order to be entitled to intervene in one of your suits against one of its customers. What do you think that is?
So MyTech could intervene. I think they could certainly come in as a cross-claimant if they believe they had a live dispute regarding indemnity. The statute...
Just a live dispute about indemnity. They wouldn't have to essentially concede an indemnity obligation?
In order to actually get involved in the dispute regarding infringement, they need to be standing... Let me take it just a step back from that framing, because I think the intervention question is actually a different legal standard than the question of what sort of indemnity obligation allows you to independently, on your own, pursue a declaratory judgment suit. Intervention is a more lenient standard that allows interested third parties to get involved in an ongoing lawsuit when they may have an interest. On the indemnity question, the reason that MITEC has to show that it has an actual obligation is because standing in a situation where you don't have an accusation directly against you, it's purely derivative. So the BP case, the DataTurn case, actually indirectly in Aris as well, this court has recognized that you don't independently get standing because you think you might need to indemnify someone. You can have standing when you literally are standing, well, figuratively standing in the shoes of a customer by way of an indemnity obligation.
They don't need to concede an indemnity obligation. Do you agree with that?
I believe they actually do need to concede an indemnity obligation, although I will say in this particular, and let me get to that in a minute, but I will say in this case that I really don't think it's dispositive because MITEC says, well, we just need to show that we have a colorable indemnity obligation, but they haven't pled or introduced any facts, anything that would suggest they have a colorable obligation, even if that were the standard. They've only alleged that they've received demands. They don't say from who or quite about what, but they never say that any of it is even colorable. And so even if their standard were correct, we'd reach the same result here. But in any event, the reason why I say they do need to show an actual indemnity obligation in order to have standing where it otherwise would not be present is because of what I mentioned. In the DataTurn case, and again in the earlier BP case, it was explained that, let me turn to the quote from BP, I think is very helpful. The agreement to defend or indemnify a third person does not provide the actual controversy whereby the defender or indemnitor may bring a declaratory judgment on its own behalf. The indemnitor's standing in such case is derivative, not original and independent. And so in order to have standing under that approach, you really need two things. You need an actual obligation, and I think particularly important for this case because we see the sort of confusion that happens without it, we need to know who it is. We can't bring an action sort of theoretically on behalf of folks that we think we might have to indemnify.
So you think what's in paragraph 13 on appendix 31 is insufficient in terms of what was pled there?
I'm sorry, paragraph?
13, appendix page 31, that talks about the indemnification from its customers or the demands for indemnification. You thought that was insufficient?
Yes, Your Honor. Let me walk through that exactly. So, let's see. I really apologize. Which paragraph?
No, it's paragraph 13, appendix page 31.
Yes, so they allege that they have various contractual relationships with its customers. Problem from the get-go is we don't even know if these are banks. I think they've acknowledged elsewhere that most of their customers are actually some sort of intermediaries and not banks. They then go on to say they include indemnification provisions relating to actual or alleged patent infringement by MITEC's technology. That doesn't tell us anything about whether or not these provisions encompass USAA's claims, but we do know one thing about whether or not MITEC is alleging that they do cover USAA's claims, which is in the appendix as well. We have MITEC's actual 10Q filing, where they specifically state to their investors that they do not believe, at least in the case of the PNC lawsuits, that they have any indemnity obligation to anyone.
But could that no indemnity obligation be because they say there's no infringement? Do you get what I'm getting at? Like there could be a distinction as to why they're making that statement.
They do make their argument in the brief, but we'll note they don't say they have no indemnity liability. They say they have no indemnity obligation. The obligation is the threshold question of whether you have an obligation to provide the indemnity. That's the threshold question of whether if somebody is liable, you have any responsibility, whatever their responsibility may be. And the reason why that's so ultimately important, again, goes back to they're trying to argue this as their hook to raise declaratory judgment suits on behalf of some group of unidentified, I guess, banks or some other sort of customer that haven't been mentioned. They could only have the ability to bring suits on behalf of these customers if there's an actual live controversy between the customer and USAA, one, and two.
No, that's not true. There doesn't have to be an actual live controversy. I mean, in the sense of a pending suit.
Not a pending suit, that's correct. A controversy in the sense of an actual legal dispute, something between the parties that's concrete and immediate, whether or not it's actually resulted in litigation or whether it's...
They say that that came from these letters.
Correct, Your Honor. That's their primary assertion, and I think that's, in fact, one of the main ways we know that there's no there there, because we have the letter, which they say is representative, which they say is copy-paste. And there's two things about that letter that are really, really important. One...
Is that letter in here?
It is, Your Honor. The letter is at... mixing up my papers a little bit. I apologize.
Appendix 44.
What's that?
Appendix 44.
Thanks.
Yes, thank you so much, Your Honor. And so this letter, a couple of really, really interesting things about it. One is that MyTech, here today in the complaint, in the district court, the two district courts, they've never alleged that anything in this letter is actually about MyTech. In fact, I think counsel said something essentially just to the contrary today. This letter, we can look through it as long as we like, and we're not going to see the word MyTech, but it's not a situation where someone's just using a code word to avoid it. There's just nothing in this letter about MyTech at all, much less any accusation.
Well, they're alleging that the customer infringes their technology, and the customers allegedly are using the MyTech technology to photograph the checks.
So let me point you to something in this 10Q statement that I think makes this easier than it otherwise.
I keep coming back. I mean, we have, you know, we're arguing about the significance of the 10Q statements. We don't have any of the infringement, any of the indemnification provisions in front of us. Why shouldn't this go back to have a hearing before the district judge to explore some of the things that the two of you are arguing about here today?
So let me answer that first, and then I want to come back briefly to the 10Q, because I do think in this case it's important, and it wasn't fleshed out in the briefing that much. So in this case, the district court had the same question, I think, as Your Honor, which is, do we need more facts here? Is there more about the indemnity obligation that we can learn? And so the district court judge actually asked MyTech's counsel at the oral argument to give more detail, to specify whether or not there were some customers as to which there is an indemnity obligation, pressed the counsel repeatedly about it. Counsel for MyTech made explicit not only that they didn't want to put more information forward, but that they were actually affirmatively making a decision to take, quote, no position.
Would you show me where they said that in the hearing?
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor.
And can you also give us the 10Q page?
Yes, let me do that just really quickly. So I have that one in front of me. It's Appendix 1049. And this is really, really important. So remember that letter is about a different family of patents. It's about a different family of patents that was at issue in the second Wells Fargo lawsuit. And here is what MyTech says in its 10Q about that family of patents, which again is the only one charted in the letter. It says, the two patents in question in the second Wells Fargo lawsuit, as the litigation involved broad banking processes and not MyTech's specific mobile deposit features.
But these are different patents.
It's the exact same patent family at issue in the letter. That's my point,
but
Your
it's
Honor.
Different. It's not the same patents, right?
It actually is. That same patent was at issue in the first Wells Fargo and the second Wells Fargo lawsuit. So that's why I say the 10Q actually is worth it in this instance. I apologize for going in the weeds. But what MyTech is saying in its 10Q is it's saying there's a group of patents that aren't about us at all. They're about broad banking processes. That's the second Wells Fargo lawsuit. Second Wells Fargo lawsuit is the one that's mentioned in that group of patents is the one that's at issue in their letter, their representative letter, and the same one in that banking article. None of these things have anything to do with the four patents at issue in this case. The letter, the article, all of that is only about the patent family at issue in the second Wells Fargo lawsuit, where MyTech is on record here at Appendix 1049 as saying it involved broad banking processes and not MyTech.
Where on that 1049 is that?
This is about six lines down from the top of page 21 at Appendix 1049.
I got it.
And then let me try to find that this quote from the district court while you are looking at that. I apologize for the delay. Oh, here we go. So this is Appendix 981 to answer your question, Judge Dyke. 981. So MyTech's counsel, after quite a bit of back and forth where the district court judge is trying to ascertain whether there's some there, and MyTech's counsel says, I think the record is clear that we do not take the position that we admit an indemnity obligation exists. Okay, that makes sense based on what they're saying. And then he goes on, I think the record, as I read it, respectfully, Your Honor, is that it is, you know, we take no position on that issue.
Wait a moment. I thought you were saying that they said they didn't want to present any further factual evidence. Where does it say that?
So here they say we take no position on that issue. This was following or perhaps immediately preceding a lengthy discussion back and forth where they're saying, well, why don't you submit letters? There's no letters.
The issue is whether there's an indemnity obligation.
Yes, correct. Maybe I misunderstood.
Not that they're not saying we don't want to make a better record. Right?
So, I mean, you can read it, I guess, multiple ways, but the discussion back and forth at the court was, well, why didn't you submit letters? And they say, you know, I'm sorry, we didn't submit letters, and kind of go back and forth about why they didn't submit letters. And then here, it is just very, very clear that they don't want to take any position at all about whether there's an indemnity.
Okay, but that's not the same thing as saying they don't want to make a better record.
It's a fair point, Your Honor, right? So we have a situation here where MyTech came forward and they identified only two different customers. They identified Wells Fargo, and the record is clear, Wells Fargo didn't ask for indemnity, was never indemnified. And then the second customer is this Mission Bank, which received a letter that doesn't say anything about infringement of any of these four patents. And MyTech is not taking the position that they had any obligation to indemnify this bank either.
Okay, so I think we're way over our time. Unless my colleagues have any further questions, I think we're done for the moment. And Mr. Mack has 2 minutes.
Thank you for your patience, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just briefly, I mean, all software is configurable. It's a dangerous precedent this court would set that any software supplier would not have DJ standing just because the software is configurable. That's what software is. There's lots
of
those.
What is your position on Judge Dyke's suggestion on a jurisdictional hearing and remanding for that?
I think a jurisdictional hearing makes a lot of sense, but I think it actually should be in the Northern District of California, not in Texas. If you looked at the, I don't know if you guys, I could briefly address the transfer issue.
This is a rebuttal argument?
it's in the briefing. It's pretty well articulated in the briefing why all of Judge Chen's analysis of those three factors were clear error. But all software is configurable. Just because you can configure the software doesn't mean it's not infringing or we don't have standing to assert a declaratory judgment action. Plus, with the monitoring criteria that you talked about, yes, there's a list of monitoring criteria. MyTech supports 10 different monitoring criteria. There still has to be some monitoring criteria. It could be brightness, it could be the skew, it could be the slant. There's maybe 10 different options. Just because the bank can choose which monitoring criteria it wants to use, that doesn't avoid infringement. There still has to be some monitoring criteria. I would just take a look at claim number one of the 090 patent. Look how incredibly broad that claim is. All it requires is monitoring for some monitoring criteria, basically just scanning over an image and then capturing the image when the monitor criteria is met. It's incredibly broad. That core functionality is provided by MySnap, MyTech software, and MyTech would like to defend its software against these spurious allegations of infringement. We think we're in the best position to do that. We think we have standing to do that. And I think that, you know, if this court were to say that no software provider would ever have DJ standing just because the software is configurable, I just don't think that's the correct precedent we want to be setting.
Okay, I think we're out of time. Thank you. Thank both counsel. The case is submitted.